The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 22nd of September, 2021, on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Daniel Bage. Coming up on today's program.
Instead of continuing to fight the wars of the past, we are fixing our eyes on devoting our resources to the challenges that hold the keys to our collective future.
President Joe Biden strikes an optimistic tone in his first address at the United Nations, but is Afghanistan still the biggest problem facing the assembly? Also ahead, Monocle's health and science correspondent Dr. Chris Smith will be telling us about plans to vaccinate younger children. And then we explore the prospect of coalition building in Germany, and Monocle's Nick Moniz rounds up this week's urbanism news.
Thanks, Daniel. I'll be here a bit later on to tell you about Baltimore's plans to revitalize its harbour and Cairo's monorail.
Looking forward to it. All that coming up right here on The Briefing with me, Daniel Bage. The Taliban have asked to address world leaders at the UN General Assembly in New York. A high-profile committee will rule on the request, but it is unlikely to happen during the UN's current session. The Taliban say they also want one of their spokespeople to serve as Afghanistan's UN ambassador. Let's get the latest now with Paul Rogers, International Security Advisor at Open Democracy. Thanks for joining us as always, Paul. First of all, let's talk about the significance of this request. Obviously, the Taliban looking to legitimize their rule. What do you make of this today?
Well, the timing is interesting. What happened was that the current ambassador to the United Nations, Ghulam Izaki, basically requested the normal presence as the legitimate representative of Afghanistan. That, I think, is in process. Afghanistan was invited, and through his person, of course, to give an address on the final day of this session, which I think is next Monday. It's not clear that's going to go ahead, but it may well do. And then just a few days ago, the foreign minister of Afghanistan, Amir Khan Mutaki, wrote formally to the United Nations, to Guterres, saying that they wanted to propose Mohammad Sahil Shaheen, who is the current Taliban representative, very much the international figure in Doha, as the new ambassador. And that is more or less where it stands. The probability is that it will not go through quickly. I mean, technically speaking, what you now have is a consideration at some point by a particular committee, a nine-country committee of the United Nations, that basically rules on anything which is controversial. The current membership is Russia, China, the United States, Sweden, South Africa, Sierra Leone, Chile, Bhutan, and the Bahamas. They are unlikely even to meet before next Monday. So in some ways, this will be kicked into touch in the short term. In the longer term, then I think it depends on a number of things. One is, I think, essentially the attitude of surrounding states. Iran, to some extent, Turkmenistan, and the others, and particularly, I think, China and Pakistan, are going to be very significant, particularly the Pakistanis. They do not seem to want to recognize the Taliban straight away, which I think is significant. They're worried about whether that reduces their hold on Afghanistan in terms of activities of what you might call the Al-Qaeda in Pakistan itself, and the Palestinian essentially paramilitaries who are loosely aligned to the Taliban, but not more than that. And Pakistan is quite important in here. The other side of the coin, though, is that the Taliban do want some kind of recognition, and many people across the United Nations and in many other countries want to see something happening, not least because Afghanistan faces a horrendous winter ahead with all sorts of food shortages. And if there are UN channels for aid, particularly the likes of UNICEF, this can be a very important way of getting things. And even countries that are very long way from recognizing the Taliban will find it possible to actually feed in aid through that sort of source, and the Taliban will certainly want that. So it's a really mixed message, but in the short term, I don't think this will get anywhere. In the longer term, it's going to be a very significant one to watch.
Well, what about negotiating or speaking with the Taliban? Beyond that, there is, of course, a security situation. Joe Biden's comments yesterday about moving forward. Many, as you say, have not recognized the Taliban. And even if Afghanistan's legitimate representative at the UN does speak, I think a lot of people are thinking more about the Taliban. How do you see that moving forward? And what is the U.S. looking for here?
No, I agree with you very much. I mean, the thing is, people will want to see some kind of progress. They're also hugely aware that this business of diplomatic recognition is one of the very sort of cards, if you like, that people who really want to see a more open Afghanistan, particularly with women's rights, see this as one way of trying to get the Taliban to accept they've really got to change direction a fair bit. Now, that's not desperately easy, given the activities of a number of UN member states, and on the women's rights side, not least Saudi Arabia itself. But I think what we will see is the sort of beginnings of a change here, and it's going to depend very much on what happens in Afghanistan in the coming weeks and maybe the next 2 or 3 months. It's worth remembering that the UN does have this kind of problem in different ways. I mean, if you take Palestine, there are 138 out of the 193 member states of the United Nations who recognize Palestine, but it is not a formally recognized state. And currently within the UN, it has what is called non-member observer status. Taiwan used to have many, many countries recognizing it at one time. At the last count, I think it's down to only 14, but there are all sorts of informal ways. The UN is a past master, if I may use that gender term, at this business of trying to sort of square circles and mixing metaphors on a go, I know again. But the point about this is there are ways forward to go in between it, and I think that is what we will see.
Very interesting, Paul. Thank you for this. That is Paul Rogers from Open Democracy. Now, here's Monocle's Chris Chermak with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Daniel. President Joe Biden has played down the chances of brokering a post-Brexit free trade deal with the UK. Biden made the comments as he entertained Prime Minister Boris Johnson at the White House. The UK is now reportedly considering joining an existing North American trade pact instead. A 5.9 magnitude earthquake has struck southeast Australia, damaging buildings in the city of Melbourne. It's thought that the quake is the most powerful to strike Australia in almost 200 years. Prime Minister Scott Morrison said there were no reports of serious injuries. Germany's business-friendly Free Democratic Party say they have little in common with the centre-left Social Democrats and the Greens. The statement suggests the parties may find it difficult to form a coalition following Sunday's federal election. We'll have more on this story a little later. And Sweden's government has announced plans to support a better work-life balance for families. The so-called Family Week allows parents to take up to 6 days of paid leave a year at 80% of their salary to spend time with their children. For more on this story, head to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Daniel.
Thank you very much, Chris. Pfizer has said that its COVID-19 vaccine works in children between the age of 5 and 11. The announcement could pave the way for its authorization in the United States and other major nations. Let's get the latest now with Monocle's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith, who is also a consultant virologist at Cambridge University. Good afternoon, Chris. For listeners out there, what should we know about this study? Obviously, we've talked a lot about whether there is a need to vaccinate children. How did this go about, and is it an encouraging study for you?
Well, this is an additional piece of information. We would have expected the vaccines to work well in all age groups because so far every age group studied has seen a response, an effective response, both against severe infection but also against just infection, against coronavirus. What Pfizer are adding here is data for younger than those that have currently been or previously been considered. We're currently seeing regulators advising that children between the ages of 12 and 16 are vaccinated with these vaccines, but we didn't have information about the safety and effectiveness of the vaccine in younger age groups, 5 up to age 12. Now we do. A trial from the States, data released by Pfizer, show that they do get a good immune response, and therefore you could consider that those individuals could be vaccinated if you needed to. But most countries are not considering, I don't think, at the moment, going down that path.
Would this help slow transmission of the virus from schools, where a lot of concern has been, and into the wider population, though? Is there a real need, do you think, to vaccinate children this young?
Well, the reason that we haven't gone down that path in countries like the UK, for example, is because if you look at where the cases are, there's a relatively high number of cases among younger people aged about 12 to 17, in fact, 12 up to 30. And that's probably for a couple of reasons, chiefly that they haven't been vaccinated hitherto, but also these are the groups in society that spend more time together. They're better socially networked. They're spending time at school, at university, public transport, or at weekend jobs, or at work, some of them. And as a result of that, they have more contacts with others. It's unsurprising they would have more cases. But when you go younger than that, you find that younger children don't have that same disproportionate representation in the case numbers. So therefore, there's a case to be made for using a vaccine in the older kids, because they do account for a disproportionate number of cases, and there will be cases of severe disease and long COVID among them, but less so among the younger kids because they're not getting infected quite so often. What this does enable us to do, though, is to say, well, look, if there are younger children who are in households where there's a vulnerable person, or they themselves have some kind of underlying health problem that means they could have a more severe run-in with COVID, you can then use a vaccine like Pfizer's vaccine on license rather than off license, and you can say they've been protected. And that means that gives you reassurance of knowing you're not operating outside the scope of regulation, but also you're operating in a way that protects that person.
I'm curious how this would impact the virus's spread in the wider population for countries that have approached coronavirus in a different way. The UK, obviously, we've gone down the road of sort of living with the virus, as we've spoken about in past on this show, versus an Australia, which has sort of closed itself off. Vaccinating younger children, would that help stopping the spread more widely? What do you think of that, Chris?
I think that there's a case to be made for older kids for the reason I've outlined, with the fact that they are accounting for a disproportionate number of cases. There are still among their number, although it's rare, people who will become severely unwell. They also can transmit the infection fairly readily amongst both their peer group, but critically also through families to older and more vulnerable people and classmates who may be more vulnerable. In terms of stopping the spread, though, I don't think that going into younger age groups therefore bears as much bang for its buck as the older kids do. And so I think probably we should use our vaccines in the younger age groups from 12 upwards, but the really young age groups, 5 to 12, I think probably that's more of a sort of a surgical approach. Let's go in with those individuals who either themselves have a severe health problem or are in a household where there's someone who's vulnerable. Those people, I think, could be better protected by that more strategic approach, and we wait for age 12 and up to have a more comprehensive across-the-board approach, because that's where the cases are.
For countries that might go ahead with vaccinating younger children, I'm thinking maybe in the United States, where there is a lot of vaccine hesitancy already. Parents obviously get very concerned about vaccines in young children. Are there any drawbacks here? Are there any concerns for you?
Not really. The evidence is these vaccines are very safe. The thing that people have pointed to is that there has been an uptick at a very low level of a condition called myocarditis. This means inflammation of the heart. And in fact, we made a piece on The Naked Scientist about it last week to address this. This is a short-term, self-limiting, spontaneously resolving, usually not at all dangerous condition that lasts for a short time and then people are fine. It happens anyway every year. This is not an unknown thing. And we normally see people in the general population getting myocarditis, probably in response to other virus infections, and including COVID. And the rate at which it happens in those contexts is actually higher than in relation to the vaccine. But this has led to people being more cautious, perhaps, because it's got headlines. But at the moment, we're seeing fewer cases of myocarditis in young people, despite the vaccination programme that does carry a small increase in risk of that, because people are not catching other things. So really, when you put all this together, this is a side effect. It does happen in a very small number of cases. It's therefore important from that perspective, but not so important that we should dismiss vaccination. And overall, the picture is one of reassuring safety for these vaccines. They do what they say on the tin. They do protect people against coronavirus infection. They protect against severe disease. They can help to stop spread. But probably we should use them, given they're in limited supply, where we get the best bang for our buck, which means we go where the cases are or where there's the greatest threat to loss of life.
Very interesting, Chris. Thank you for this explainer. That was Monocle 24's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. The global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, the company is working on breakthrough treatments that push the boundaries of human understanding in biology, data science, and engineering to develop and deliver therapies that help people live longer and healthier lives around the world. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You're back with a briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Bage. Germany will head to the polls on Sunday, but we have little idea who might form a governing coalition. Things became even more murky overnight when the pro-business Free Democratic Party, who are seen as potential kingmakers, said they could struggle to find common ground with the center-left SPD and the Greens. Anna Rosenberg is head of Europe and the UK at the political consultancy Signum Global. Good to have you back on the show, Anna, and I'm glad you're here because I need a little help, I think, with all the acronyms of all the different parties in Germany at this time. Tell us first a little bit about the FDP.
Hi, good to talk to you. So the FDP is a pro-business liberal party. They have been in government before, but for many years they haven't. They've torpedoed the last government formation, which could have been a government of CDU, Greens and FDP, because they did not like to work with Angela Merkel. And as a result, you got another grand coalition of SPD and CDU. So they have been kingmakers before, and they have been pretty principled in what they want to do and what they do not want to do. So the latest comments are a bit concerning in that they increase the risk of a far left outcome, but they also ironically increase the likelihood of a centrist government outcome.
Well, tell us a little bit about what the polls are saying now and how this could impact things. I mentioned the idea of the FDP being potential kingmakers. How are they playing into coalition talks now?
So the polls right now are telling us, you know, things that I think are a little bit difficult to translate, because I don't have very high faith and trust in the polls right now. I don't think they tell us the full story that is going on. For example, if you look at the fall of the CSU recently compared to the rise of the SPD, an odd thing seems to have occurred, which indicates that a lot of CDU voters have directly gone to the SPD, which is highly unlikely, because a core CDU voter would never go to the SPD. So it seems to me, and this is a theory that we have, that one of the reasons why the CDU-CSU has been performing so poorly in the polls is because of this whole power struggle that was going on at the, you know, at the leadership on the CDU over which candidate would represent the CDU-CSU. And there were a lot of people that were disgruntled by the choice of Armin Laschet over Markus Söder. And I think that's what we're seeing going on in the polls at the moment. Ultimately, these people are core CDU voters. And if they're standing at the ballot box, they're not going to make a cross at the SPD. They're going to make a cross at the CDU. And that's why I think the polls are somewhat misleading and they're not showing us the full story. Right now, there are many possible coalition outcomes. We have about 9 different outcome possibilities. The most likely ones are a CDU-CSU plus Greens plus FDP, that's our base case, at around 25%. But the second and third most likely ones are a government led by the SPD, the Greens and the FDP at 20%, and a government that is far left by the Greens, the SPD and Die Linke, which we also have a 20% likelihood.
So from what you're saying there, there is a good possibility that the CDU could be shut out altogether. Is that because of that leadership squabble you mentioned, or just this fact that voters are thinking about how it might come together?
Yes, simply because of the leadership squabble, but also because Armin Laschet is just not a very popular politician. And quite frankly, he is not a very apt campaigner. In the last TV debate, it became apparent that he doesn't give good and clear answers to specific questions. It's not clear what he stands for. So I think that he isn't really a good campaigner. That undermines the CDU-CSU possibility, but also the issue on the leadership battle. Absolutely. I think this is where we are standing. But our base case still remains that we're going to have a government that is either led or inclusive of the CDU-CSU, because what could also happen is that even though the SPD leads by a small margin, that a coalition is formed against the SPD. And Lindner, the FDP's leader, the comments that he made yesterday actually emphasize that. He said, we have very little in common with the SPD and the Greens. The only thing we have in common is we could all legalize cannabis. But beyond that, I don't think we would be getting anything done. So that emphasizes the point that the FDP would be willing to forge a coalition with the CDU-CSU against the SPD.
Very briefly, Anna, what are the issues that you're seeing from your analysis that people are most concerned with? And what are those issues that could bring these coalitions together?
So we obviously advise financial markets investors, and the issues that they're most concerned with are how much debt is the new German government going to take on? How much are they going to invest in the economy? That's a key issue that all parties say they really have to, because Germany has underinvested a lot in the recent years. Another issue that our clients, financial markets investors, care about is will the next German government make EU debt being a joint thing a permanent tool as a result of the EU recovery fund or not? And then, of course, for voters in Germany, the biggest issue right now is the climate.
Very interesting, Anna. Thank you so much for this check-in. That's Anna Rosenberg from consultancy Signum Global. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. We'll continue now with a quick roundup of the day's main business news with Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. Good afternoon, Ewan. The spike in gas and electricity prices is preoccupying European Union talks today. What can you tell us?
Yeah, it was meant to be a debate about the European Green Deal. A meeting of energy ministers in Slovenia, though, today has been hijacked by the issue of gas and electricity prices. They are surging across Europe and is causing big problems for consumers and for governments. And they're trying to work out what to do about it. Now, Europe is facing a gas shortage after a long and bitter winter left storage sites depleted, and refilling them this summer hasn't been easy. Russia has not been pumping as much gas as expected. And of course, Russia, the predominant supplier across much of the European continent. And also competition for LNG, liquefied natural gas. A lot of that is going to Asia, not as many of those ships arriving as we would like. Here in the UK, there's also plenty of problems. A number of small suppliers have gone out of business. It's a very competitive market to supply households in the UK. And within the last 48 hours, a number of suppliers have said they're not taking on any more customers. A report that Bulb, the number six supplier, one of the relatively big companies, is having some financial trouble, also reported today. The problem in the UK is that there is a price cap imposed by the government, and a number of customers are on fixed price deals. They've been agreed with companies over the last couple of years. There's been an increase in that, but the companies, if they haven't hedged their purchasing, that means that they are caught in the middle, as the price that they're charging doesn't meet the price that they are paying for the gas and the electricity, which has been ramping up, of course, over recent weeks. So a big problem right across Europe at the moment.
And Ewan, just tell us lastly about a rare acquisition by Netflix.
Yeah, Netflix has agreed to buy the works of novelist Roald Dahl. Now, the streaming giant plans to use Dahl's characters for animated and live-action films and TV series, games, theatre shows and consumer products. Many of Roald Dahl's books have already made it to Hollywood, James and the Giant Peach and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory being a couple of examples. Netflix already had a three-year-old agreement with the Roald Dahl Story Company to make animated shows based on his material. So this is really widening that deal. They're buying up the entire catalogue. It's a pretty big deal. It's unusual for Netflix. They've generally grown by organically. They haven't really done many acquisitions. They've done about 10 deals over the course of the past decade, but they've got big, they've more than 209 million subscribers now. They've got big generally by growing the business, but we don't know the terms of this deal, but it is likely to be the biggest deal that Netflix has ever done.
Very interesting and one to watch, Ewan. That was Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally on today's program, Monocle's Nick Moniz is here with me in studio for a little roundup of the week's best urbanism stories. And Nick, you've decided to start today in Baltimore. Tell us about the wetlands there.
We are, Daniel. The reason I like this story is it does sort of relate to cities everywhere. You know, the environments that they're built in are often so significantly altered from, I guess, the natural landscape that was originally there. And obviously, this is the case with Baltimore. Their inner harbour was once a shallow, tidal salt marsh teeming with fish and crabs and really trying to paint a romantic, you know, seaside picture for you here. But it was essentially dredged to be transformed into a deep water shipping port, which is obviously good for the economy and development, but bad for a ecology.
And a plot from The Wire.
Oh, there you go. I'm not educated. That's one I've been dodging for ages. I pretend I've seen it and I haven't. But the National Aquarium are now funding the construction of an expansive floating wetland system. They've been trialling a floating wetland in the water adjacent their Harbourside campus for about 4 years now, and I guess want it to grow further. And I guess that initial trial was already about, you know, testing whether this would actually work as a nursery for hatching native fish and a safe shallow space for blue crabs to shed their shells, and it's proved to have worked, and hopefully this expansion, this development, will obviously bring more ecology and more of that, I guess, traditional or original landscape back into the harbour, but also provide nice green space, waterside green space for residents to walk past.
Sounds very interesting. Let us move on to Cairo now, who's learned nothing from The Simpsons, who needed to stop an out-of-control monorail. They want to build one.
I really do love this, and I thought there was discussion off air that you were going to do the monorail chant from The Simpsons. Is that a thing that's going to happen, or have I misunderstood?
Maybe later. Yes.
Okay. Look forward to that on the editorial floor. But essentially, the first two of 70 monorail trains for Cairo have been delivered to the city earlier this month. They were manufactured in the UK, and they're going to run along the two new monorail lines in the Egyptian capital's greater metropolitan area. Essentially, there's a 154-kilometre long line connecting the eastern part of Cairo with the new administrative city, and a 42-kilometre line connecting to Giza. And I guess I like this, and maybe that's why The Simpsons made fun of it, because of the novelty of the transport mode. I mean, there are often detractors. They're difficult to maintain because they're elevated and maybe can be a bit of a blight on a city landscape. But I think you know, they've opted for them because in this case that it is a sensible move. It allows you to, I guess, knock down fewer properties and you don't need to, I guess, kick people out of homes and businesses as significantly as if you were going to put in something along the ground. So, look, less intrusive rather than traditional rail. And I think, yeah, just a fun novelty for the city.
Now, from monorails to tram trains, another story from the Railway Gazette. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so smart window technology is being trialled on a tram line in the German city of Karlsruhe. And it will last for 6 months. And I'm sure you're asking what smart window technology is, Daniel.
Yes.
I will answer that question for you. Essentially, it's a digital display or a screen mounted on a window showing the live movement of the tram and allowing you, I guess, to plan your journey with a route map, and there's connection information and points of interest highlighted along the route, and can obviously also link up with a smartphone app. Now, this has been rolled out with funding from the Federal Transport Ministry, about 2.86 million euro, and run by the local university. I think it is it's a good thing, you know, particularly for people that, you know, maybe they don't have access to a smartphone, whether that's a traveller that doesn't have the local app or an elderly person. My only issue is that these are blocking entire windows. And I think the beauty of riding the tram is actually being able to, you know, if you're highlighting points of interest but can't look out the window and see them, it seems a little bit redundant to me. So hopefully, I think this trial is ultimately a good thing, but hopefully they find a sleeker solution that lets you have the best of both.
Very interesting, Nick. Thank you for that. That is Monocle's Nick Moniz with his Urbanism Roundup. And that is all for this edition of The Briefing, produced today by Rhys James. Our researcher was Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, and our studio manager was Louis Allen. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. That's 1300 in Zurich, noon here in London, 7 a.m. in Baltimore. I'm Daniel Bache. Goodbye, and thank you so much for listening.